Progressive Radio News Hour with Stephen Ledman, Thursdays at 11 a.m. and weekends at 1 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Guest today, I'm delighted to have him back again, Stepan Mestrovic. Stepan is professor of sociology at Texas A&M University. He's the author of The Good Soldier on Trial, a sociological study of misconduct by the U.S. military pertaining to Operation Iron Triangle Iraq. You think we only rain mischief against people in other countries? We do it against our own forces. We enlist young men and women on false pretenses to go abroad to, quote-unquote, defend democracy and share it with others. And we betray the people whose countries we invade, occupy, and we betray our own people as well. We simply don't give a damn about them. They're just cannon fodder to be used and abused and, in some cases, to be imprisoned. For obeying orders, mind you. For obeying orders, that can land you in prison if you're a private or a sergeant or whatever. But never if you're a colonel or a general, or heaven forbid, four-star ones in the Pentagon and Secretary of Defense and the President and the other top people who give the orders and tell these people to commit these crimes. And then we hang out some lower-level ones to dry. Some loyalty to the troops, some loyalty to the people whose countries we absolutely lay waste to. So people like the Egyptians are pretty much tired of the Mubarak regime that gets billions of dollars annually from America to suppress them. We want to talk about that, and we want to talk about some things on my guest's mind that he is very much involved in, and it all wraps up in the same package. Imperial America just rampaging globally, including at home, and it simply doesn't care what harm it causes, to whom, how many, as long as it profits in the end the way the people who benefit want to. Stepan, I welcome you to the program. It's great having you back.
It's a delight being here. Thank you, Stephen.
Oh, shall we start on Egypt and then go on all these other issues?
Absolutely.
I would say of all the courageous disruption going on in the world today, the epicenter is in Egypt. And I watch that, Stepan, and I listen to it, and I think about it, and I've sure written enough about it, and I wonder, what will it take to spread that spirit globally? Because there's an awful lot of persecuted people in the world, including millions right here in America. Why aren't they rallying for their freedom the way the Egyptians are doing it?
Well, Stephen, I think one of the pieces you wrote, "We Are All Egyptians Now," is really wonderful, and I think you wonderfully tie together what's going on in Egypt to what went on after the fall of communism. And in general, I agree with you. It's a very exciting time in Egypt, but you can see already that the signs are there that the Western powers want to put a lid on this for various reasons, economic, political, that the hold of the U.S. empire is being shaken very, very badly. You know, there's no real push by the West to get Mubarak out, which is what the protesters mostly want. They're trying to reach some kind of compromise, some kind of deal. So, you know, because I'm an academic, I think I want to look back on one of the oldest sources on this. Alexis de Tocqueville wrote a book called The Ancient Regime and Revolution. He was writing about the French Revolution. But his point is still well taken, and namely that when a revolution gets going, there's a real danger that the people are going to be hoodwinked into a resurgence of the old regime that they were trying to go against. In other words, the people now in Egypt, they want basically a decent, dignified livelihood. They want Mubarak out of power. People in power know that this is what they want, and they can be tricked into believing that they'll get those things, but the old regime, I think it's a wonderful phrase, may come back or may remain. So I think there's a real danger of that.
Oh, indeed. So I'm no expert on history, Stephen, but I'm trying to reflect on what revolts have ever been successful. The one that comes to mind immediately is in modern times, is the one that took place in the 1950s in Cuba, and of course that was an armed revolt. It had good leadership. Castro was a mighty, mighty tough opponent, and he didn't deliver a perfect system to the Cubans, but he certainly delivered one an awful lot better than the one they got rid of, and the roots of how despotic it was, just like around the world today, the roots of it were in Washington, and it was a bloody despotic regime under Batista. And the Cubans were really ready for something else. But again, I mean, you look back, the French Revolution and our own revolution, so-called revolution here in this country, 1776. I've described it the way a man who wrote a wonderful book about that time and what the founding fathers really wanted, and the last thing in the world they wanted was democracy. And I forget his, I quoted him, he just did some brilliant writing, a man named Ferdinand Lundberg, and he wrote a book called Cracks in the Constitution that I was able to get a used copy of on the recommendation of somebody else, and I found one for $10. Oh, what a buy, what a find. If listeners can get a copy of Cracks in the Constitution, oh, by all means get hold of it, but I reviewed the book in some detail, and anybody can Google my name, and Cracks in the Constitution, and they'll find my review. And one of the expressions that Lundberg used in his book was nothing really changed. We just had a change in management, not a change in the system. So instead of a monarch, we got a president who the founders wanted to make a monarch. But maybe the one good thing Washington did, well, he did a few good things. He did an awful lot of bad things, but he did a few good things. And one good thing was he didn't want to be a monarch, and he didn't want to be president for life, so he set a precedent. A precedent. But we certainly didn't get democracy, Stephen, back then. My goodness, only white property owners could vote. Women couldn't vote. Blacks weren't people, they were property. Indians were being exterminated. What kind of a country is this that we founded? and it's only gotten worse down through the ages.
Yeah, all that's true, but I still think it was better at the time anyway than what the French and the British had. So I think we have to measure these things in baby steps.
Oh, yeah,
and
I agree.
In increments. So the real question is, and it's the issue you raise, are the Egyptians going to get more of the same, go backwards, get the ancient regime, so to speak, disguised as a new regime? And how much real, genuine support is there going to be? And the issue that I see is it's already being characterized, as you know, by the media, some of the media, in terms of Islamophobia, that, you know, Egypt, is, of course, is a Muslim country, but the word Muslim is enough to make ordinary Americans scared of anything that has to do with power. So the fear is already that whoever replaces Mubarak is going to be so-called radical and so forth. In other words, it's hard to be sympathetic to ordinary Egyptians who just want freedom, democracy, and a dignified way of living.
Well, our media very definitely is not sympathetic, and yet at the same time, I'm surprised that compared to the way we cover other events around the world, which aren't too many, unless America goes to war, Stephen, the way America's learned geography is when this country attacks and invades another country, then they discover it exists. And even more or less where it is, otherwise they know nothing, and our media generally neglects reporting about the rest of the world. But in reporting about Egypt, there has been at least some modest support for the Egyptian people in the sense of interviewing people who are part of the protest or who support the protest, but not doing it to the extent that we should. If you look at the difference between CNN, which is a global operation, compared to the other U.S. networks, there really are not. If you look at CNN and compare it to Al Jazeera, the coverage is just worlds apart. Al Jazeera does such a wonderful job, and CNN is, my goodness, so compromised.
Right, but Al Jazeera is not available on cable TV in most places in the United States.
That's right.
And in terms of CNN, I mean, one of the best things that could have happened for the Egyptian, I mean, I hate to say it, is that Anderson Cooper got beat up, because the sympathy among the American people was for beating up Anderson Cooper, who was a media star. And it was from that that you could tell the tone of CNN and New York Times changed immediately, because prior to that event, they were actually calling Mubarak's thugs, you know, anti or the other side, they were calling them demonstrators. And it was only after Anderson Cooper got beat up that they started calling them, you know, thugs, which is what they were. So it was pro-democracy and anti-democracy, supposedly demonstrators. You can't demonstrate against democracy. But that's the term that was being tossed about before that event.
Oh, yeah. I don't follow the reports on U.S. media that carefully. But I watched a little bit, but exactly how the tone changed, I wasn't monitoring, so I didn't follow it. But I'm not certain who beat up Anderson Cooper. Maybe good Egyptian protesters wanting democracy did it, but we know that the government unleashed its rogue security forces in plain clothes to go out and create all kinds of mischief, in some cases, to blame on the protesters.
Right, but that was not initially the way it was depicted, because the media was biased, you know, against the demonstrators, the pro-democracy demonstrators. Initially, it was portrayed as just, you know, sort of a, well, you know, the media always does this. It was like when Yugoslavia was breaking up, the Serbs were put on equal par with the Muslims. It's always like those people, oh, look at those people fighting each other, you know, ancient tribal hatreds, that kind of thing. Nobody wants to take sides. I think there are certain elements, like Anderson Cooper, which dramatically change the perception and the way we conceptualize what's going on.
Oh, I think that there are probably many other instances of that happening the same way, and I don't know about our government, Stepan, whether we were really caught as red-handed as some reports claim. In one of my articles, I quoted forget the precise name, a U.S. Air Force Institute of Research of some kind, a report that went back a few years where they pretty much were talking about the Mubarak regime being very creaky and unstable and unreliable, and really suggesting that we needed a replacement for this guy because he no longer was serving this well. This goes back a few years. And I quoted a senior CIA analyst. This was from the New York Times. They had it. I forget the woman's name. But she talked about a very brief statement saying that we knew Egypt was unstable. We just couldn't tell when there might be a spark that would really set everything off and cause what's going on today. Well, unless we initiated it, of course, you never know the moment something might erupt, but I have a feeling that we understood that after three decades, Mubarak just may have outlived his usefulness. The problem is, you want a Mubarak regime. It doesn't matter who heads it.
Right. Exactly.
The idea is you want the same thing, and it can be under Mubarak, it can be under Joe Smith, it could be under your next door neighbor. It simply doesn't matter.
Yes. Yes. But again, you know, you're talking about reports which for the most part are kept secret. The man on the street, what they saw through Al Jazeera was that the tear gas canisters had in big letters made in the USA. The man on the street figured out that the tanks that were being used against the protesters were brand new M1 tanks from the US Army, you know, bought from the US. So it looks very bad for the United States in terms of its cultural symbolism being used in the very weapons that are being used to repress the pro-democracy demonstrators. So that's how we really got caught if you want, you use the phrase, you know, red-handed. It's not so much the reports, which most people are not going to know about, but it's going to be the shells, the canisters, the tear gas, the equipment, the helicopters, and people are putting that together. So I think the U.S. is being perceived in the Arab world as just being on the wrong side.
You know, Tiffany, I'm still mystified. I know there are basic issues aside from our meddling in the region, deep poverty, unemployment, repression by the Mubarak regime, regardless of tanks from the U.S. and so on. But I'm still mystified why these people on the streets aren't also rallying against Imperial America, because we're really the root of their problems. We back a guy like Mubarak. We give him billions of dollars. We sell him the tanks and the planes and the tear gas. Why aren't they rallying against America? I'm just mystified by that.
Well, you know, as a sociologist, I would say right now they have immediate concerns, which is food and just basic freedoms. So something like taking on an imperialist power is going to be further down the list of their priorities. I mean, when a person is hungry and can't feed their family, that's the first thing you think about, basic needs.
Oh, I absolutely agree with that. What bothers me, though, is that the root of their hunger and unemployment and repression is headquartered in Washington. So if they don't figure out a way for them to succeed, they need somehow to get out from under America's yoke. And there's no way of getting around that, because we're around, and we want to dominate the region and, of course, the whole world. And as long as we're a force to deny them the freedoms that they want, they absolutely have to reckon with us.
Yeah, I agree with that, Stephen, but the flip side of that is the Arab regimes have a very poor history of their own leaders who lead them to, you know, a democratic kind of future. I mean, just look at the whole region around Egypt, Saudi Arabia, Yemen, Syria. Those are all dictators. So they don't have much to fall back on in order to achieve this kind of revolt. I mean, the flip side of what you're saying is that because of decades of these kinds of oppressive regimes, there has not been a bedrock, there has not been a, if you will, a nursery that could have produced the kind of leaders that can say those kinds of things and that can bring them to a true democracy.
Well, there's no question. There's no question how true that is. And the only Arab country with a semblance of democracy is Lebanon. They have at least somewhat reasonable elections, and they have this confessional system where the government has to be divided by a formula of Sunni, Shia, and Christian. I mean, it's crazy. Democracy doesn't divide along religious lines, so that's a gross imperfection in this system. But compared to other Arab regimes, there simply is not anything remotely close to democracy in any one of them, from Morocco in the west to Egypt and Jordan in the east. They're all despotic regimes, monarchies or whatever they are. They certainly are not democracies, and they never have had democracies.
Right, and this is where I go back to Tocqueville. I mean, as much as, you know, one can criticize the United States, and as you have rightly, I think Tocqueville had a point that for many, many decades, this is empirically correct, the way the United States was perceived was as a beacon of light set upon a hill. I mean, there were a lot of countries who were so much worse off than the United States that they saw it as a role model in terms of basic freedoms in the Constitution compared to their own systems. But what's happened in the past 20 or so years, for sure, and especially in the past 10 years after Abu Ghraib and after some of these fiascos, is that the image of the United States in terms of human rights has been badly tarnished. So you have a vacuum here where the Arab people don't have their own leaders who can point to a democratic vision, but you also don't have a template, a role model, a beacon of light set upon a hill either. It's been tarnished. So, you know, as a sociologist, I see this as a very confusing and chaotic time, because it's very hard to orient oneself to an image, a symbol, a cultural beacon, if you will, that can set the right direction.
Oh, again, how true. And in general, matching up people against entrenched power is really a very unfair fight. I mean, countries, the U.S. is the most powerful, of course, but all countries have their military and their security forces, and the people just have their will, their spirit, to want to go out in big, big numbers. And it's rare that it happens the way it's especially happening in Egypt, but also in Tunisia, in Jordan, in Yemen, and somewhat in Algeria. And smaller eruptions could happen anywhere in the region, and small ones at times have a habit of becoming bigger ones, but still you're going up against the power of the state, and they have a lot more guns and tanks than the people have. The people just have their bodies.
Right. That's right. I mean, sadly, what this could end up as is what happened in Iran a couple of years ago. It could be totally brutally suppressed. I mean, that's a very real possibility. Of course, one hopes that it will succeed, and that they will actually have free and democratic elections. But there's a real danger that it may not succeed.
I think the odds are long against them, and I've said that in several articles. My heart is absolutely with them. I wish there was something, I wish I had the power somehow to elevate them and give them a better chance for success. And yet just my knowledge of history tells me that succeeding in anything, even something as massive as this is, and sustained, and these people just doggedly stay out there, although I discovered one reason why they stay out, because the Egyptian security forces are so brutal that they are literally trying to find out who possibly could be behind this, even in secondary or tertiary roles. And then where do these people live? And they want to go find them if they happen to be at home at any time and take them away. And one of Egypt's specialties is disappearing people.
Right.
They get you in their grasp, and they torture you brutally, and they interrogate you brutally to find the names of compatriots, and then nobody ever sees or hears from you again. So
Right. People
are staying in the streets, Stefan, because it's safer in the streets than going home.
Right. That's a really profound insight. I agree with that.
I mean, it's incredible to think of it that way, but you have to wonder. I mean, this thing is what? It's getting on to 2 weeks that they've been out there, close to 2 weeks. And you're saying, my God, how do you sleep in the streets night after night?
Right.
Where do you eat? Where do you go to the bathroom? Where do you do all the things you do so easily? It's all accessible at home, but it's
right. Not
in the streets. And if you're masked with a million people, you can't even get out of that crowd unless you're on the fringes. And yet these people keep coming back out and out and out over and over again. The crowds ebb a little bit overnight, and then in the daytime they slowly build and build and build again. And the numbers on Friday after Friday prayers, I saw, you know, nobody knows exactly how many people were out there, but I saw estimates that range from 1 to 2 million in Cairo, plus other protests around the country. It's absolutely extraordinary. I never remember anything like this.
No, I agree. I don't either. I think the decisive factor is going to be which way the Egyptian military is going to swing.
And so far they've been pretty calm, pretty much on the sidelines, and it strikes me that they're that Washington's orders, and they very, very definitely take orders from Washington. When you give them billions of dollars every year, you get a lot of order giving rights. And I think the orders from Washington are literally a transition over so many days away from Mubarak to new names with the same system,
mm-hmm.
and with the coverage that these protests are getting. It is simply bad press to go out for the military to be brutalizing the people on the streets, and oh, could they ever cause carnage if they wanted to? That does not look good on CNN, even on Al Jazeera.
Right, but of course, you know, it appears that the military is neutral, but then you have to ask the logical question, how is it that the thugs were allowed into the square on camels and horses? And the obvious answer is that the military allowed them in.
Oh, yeah.
So, you know, they may want to put up that appearance for the reasons that you cite, but again, the decisive factor is going to be which way they sincerely, genuinely want to go. If they've had enough of Mubarak and see a better leader, or if they want to stay with this regime. I think that's going to be the decisive factor.
Oh, absolutely. You know, we wish we could be a fly on the wall when these people sit down and talk about just what's going on and what are they planning and what do they want and so on. My best guess is days ago, maybe even once these protests began, my feeling is, and it's only speculation, that the Obama administration told Mubarak, you're gone, you're out, we will handle the transition, and you can have a reasonable amount of time to do what you want to do, make sure your billions of stolen dollars are secure for you. We're not going to touch those. 70 billion is the number that I saw. I have a draft of a new article for tomorrow, again on Egypt, Stefan, and I quote from a London Guardian article in it that there are estimates that Mubarak and his family and his son, they're all billionaires. And the estimate is that they have somewhere on the order of $70 billion. $70 billion.
Incredible.
Well, you can buy a lot of safe haven with $70 billion.
Right.
you might even be able to buy your own city with $70 billion.
Right.
So I think he knows he's leaving. And he may even know the day he's leaving, but some other material that I discovered, and I put it in this article, quoting the source, that they're dragging out this game of getting rid of him, again, to retain the regime, is because Egypt has been a vital destination for America's torture and rendition program, and
yes.
Mubarak has been a loyal ally supporting it, and they also have documents and computer files, and the CIA is actively working in Egypt, apparently, getting their hands on all of these files to get them out of Egypt and back to America safe and sound, so America's fingerprints aren't on this torture and rendition program that America runs using Egypt. And there's also some concern. There are lots of locations they can send people to be tortured and rendition and tortured, but Egypt, I gather, has been a key destination. So losing that under a new regime, if America doesn't get exactly what it wants, that's a great concern to Washington. I mean, this stuff is awfully ugly. It just
incredible.
Gets uglier all the time, Steph.
It's just incredible, yep.
We want to keep the torture going, and we don't care about $70 billion stolen, and we want to keep the regime in place under new names. And Obama says, we support the democratic rights of the Egyptian people. In a pig's eye, we support their democratic rights. Oh, my goodness. Shall we segue to some of the things that you're working on and so concerned about? It may be a good way to do it. Maybe you could introduce it. And you want it, we're right at a break time, so we'll take a break and come back, and we'll use
okay.
the second half of the program for the things you're focused on, including an important definition of conspiracy that you want to read.
Okay.
Let's take that break, and we'll be right back.
Listening to PRN, Progressive Radio Network.
What will be the impact of a Tea Party on the upcoming midterm elections? Who are these Tea Partiers? Are they really only a bunch of right-wing rednecks? Listen in every Thursday night from 7 until 8 Eastern to A More Perfect Union as your host, Bill Thompson, gets the inside stories from actual Tea Party players. Call in with your comments and questions, challenge guests, or show support. A More Perfect Union, Thursday nights, 7 until 8, only on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com.
Hey, did you miss your favorite show? Don't worry, PRN has you covered. Just log on to ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com and go to the archive page where you can choose from any of our great programs. Listen or download shows from yesterday or even ones dating months back. The Progressive Radio Network, striving to make your lives easier.
Hi, this is Karen Hartglass. And I am a vegan. No, I am not an alien from planet Vega. I simply choose to eat plant-based foods. Join me on Ask a Vegan every Sunday at 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. We'll be talking about everything from soup to nuts. Plant-based foods are the healthiest foods to eat, as well as being the most economical, the most compassionate, and the least destructive. If you want to know more about the healthy, planet-friendly, plant-based diet, call in with your questions. Or call in and share your favorite vegan recipes. Tune in on Sunday at 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on www.progressiveradionetwork.com.
This is Glenn Ford. Join me and co-host Nellie Bailey every Monday at 5 p.m. Eastern Time for Black Agenda Radio, an hour of news, analysis, and commentary from a black left perspective. That's Black Agenda Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.
You are listening to Progressive Radio Network.
Welcome back on What's Hip on Mestrovic. And we'll shift from Egypt and the Middle East to other rooms. There are many, many important issues, including many here in America and all across the globe. And we can focus heavily on things that are really riveting and need a lot of attention. But it's crucial not to avoid talking about the others as well. Stepan, introduce the things that you've been so focused on, and then get into the important definition of conspiracy that you would like to read to listeners.
Okay, well, since about the year 2005, I've been an expert witness in sociology for a number of cases involving war crimes by U.S. soldiers. That's Abu Ghraib cases, Operation Iron Triangle, Baghdad Canal killings, and one right now, a new one in Afghanistan. And what's interesting is, along the lines of what you said earlier in the program, is that these soldiers follow orders that come from very high up. In the case of Abu Ghraib, the Levin-McCain report established clearly, conclusively, that the memorandums allowing the torture, allowing, mandating, in fact, the abusive techniques came from White House lawyers. And they say very explicitly that the abuse was not the fault of the so-called seven rotten apples. And so on for the other cases as well. What's really shocking is that despite these reports which come out, there's a disconnect in that nobody goes back then and asks, well, who are the soldiers who were blamed for this abuse, which was orchestrated at such high levels? What happened to them? And in going back and looking at transcripts, I've seen one common theme in all of them, and that is they're not convicted for a specific act alone. They have to add the charge of conspiracy, because that's what really carries the heavy punishment. In other words, in the Abu Ghraib cases, there was one soldier who was convicted basically for taking one photograph, not a dozen or five, or not hurting anybody. He didn't punch anybody. He didn't kick anybody. He didn't yell at anybody. He took one photo. But from that one photo, they got conspiracy out of it. And he was not only sent to Leavenworth, but he had to testify against the others. So I want to read to you this definition of conspiracy, which is not only used in military court-martials, but in federal courts throughout the country. Quote, in a conspiracy, the agreement does not have to be in any particular form or expressed in formal words. It is sufficient if the minds of the parties reach a common understanding to accomplish the object of the conspiracy. And this may be proved by the conduct of the parties. The agreement does not have to express the manner in which the conspiracy is to be carried out or what part each conspirator is to play. The overt act required for this offense does not have to be a criminal act, but it must be a clear indication that the conspiracy is being carried out. The overt act may be done either at the time or following the agreement. The overt act must clearly be independent of the agreement itself. That is, it must be more than merely the act of entering into the agreement or an act necessary to reach the agreement, end quote. I heard a military lawyer tell me that basically, in his words, this definition of conspiracy means whatever the government wants it to mean, and they can get anybody they want to get with it. Because you notice when I read it that there's no plot, there's no real agreement, and there's no burden on the government to prove that people sat down and actually planned something. It says that the agreement does not have to be in any particular form. That's an incredibly shocking sentence. It does not have to be in any form. It doesn't say like some form, you know. It just says it doesn't have to be in any form. I mean, I just find it shocking that this far into the millennium, such a plastic, fluid, all-encompassing definition can be used, and there's hardly any discussion of it except when you talk to individual lawyers who are very, very frustrated by it if they have to defend somebody when the charge is made.
Can I add one comment?
Sure.
One of my core topics, Stepan, is political prisoners, mainly in this country, but I've written on some in Canada, and I've certainly written on some Palestinians targeted by Israelis. And I have discussed conspiracy in my articles, because I always try to find out the specific charges, as close to the specific charges against people as possible. And invariably, these innocent people, among what other offenses they may be charged with, they're charged with conspiracy. And
right.
In some cases, they're only charged with conspiracy. And my conclusion has been, for some time, I've written on my goodness, well over 50 individuals. I've yet to find a single guilty one, and yet every single one, with no exception, was charged and convicted and put in prison, and they're all innocent. They're all innocent. They all did nothing. Nearly always, there was no plot, no crime, and yet these people are sitting in prison. Some of them with sentences long enough that they will die in prison. And incredibly, in a couple of cases, people sent to prison for giving charity. But my feeling about conspiracy has been that when you have no evidence to charge somebody with a crime, you charge them with the crime, quote-unquote, of conspiracy.
Right. I mean, I can give you examples, for example, of soldiers who would be sitting in a Humvee parked, and they say in their defense they had no idea that what the other soldiers were doing maybe 200 yards away. None. Zero. But by virtue of sitting there in that Humvee while somebody else was committing a crime, they're guilty of conspiracy. You know, and judges like to read them the example. It's like, well, if you're plotting to rob a bank and you don't actually do it, but you talk to somebody. But the point is, this definition is extended that even if you didn't know, using the judge's example, that the bank was being robbed or somebody else was doing it, you're still guilty just by physically being there or physically not being there. I mean, this gets even more ludicrous. In the Abu Ghraib cases, there were soldiers who were physically not present during the alleged conspiracy and still convicted of conspiracy.
You know, so, I didn't know that. I had no idea.
Yeah, it's kind of like reading Catch-22, and it's tragic comic when you read the transcripts, because the judge is told at a certain point, well, Your Honor, two of the people on your list were actually not there. And the judge goes, okay, we'll temporarily strike their names. And then after their names are struck to convict that one person, they go back and get those guys anyway. It's hard to believe unless you go over the transcripts. And of course, another one of the problems is that these transcripts are not readily available. I mean, if we're going to call these people war criminals, and they're really just basically good, decent U.S. soldiers, you know, I think these things should be made public. There should be the transparency that we claim that we have in our legal system. But that's not there for the average person to find. So it's really shocking. And then, of course, there's a lot of fallout from these cases because, as you and I have discussed before, there's an attorney named Paul Berggren who is still awaiting trial. I think it's going to be on May 10th. And the charges against him are also basically conspiracy. In other words, he did not. None of these cases are like classic whodunit cases, you know, actually killing somebody or robbing somebody or anything of that sort. It's more like, oh, you received a phone call, or you knew this person, and then this person did something else, so you're guilty of conspiracy. I really think it's something that needs just incredible attention, and credible reform, because it's just like such a tool for oppression.
It really is. It really is, Stephen. And Paul, who I've written about and we've discussed his case on this program before, he's one of two attorneys who I know. I've never met Paul, but he's in a New York City jail doing hard time in jail ahead of his trial. He's being railroaded. Another lawyer who was convicted in her trial, serving a 10-year sentence, a glorious human being, human rights lawyer, Lynn Stewart. And I've written numerous times about Lynn, and I know her personally. And I exchange emails between myself and Lynn and Paul. Can I read you a three-line email that Paul overnight sent to Fran Hunsinger, who you know well, and her son is one of the victims, and you've written about him, Bill Hunsinger, also in Leavenworth, right?
Right.
A guy who wanted to serve his country.
Very much so, very passionately so.
He was passionate about it, and his reward was so many years in Leavenworth. How outrageous does it get when this is what a country does to its own people? Here's Paul's email. He wanted me, I mean, he could have just told me this in an email. I don't know why he told Fran, but he did, and Fran emailed me overnight. He said, in response, he said, quote, "Everything is good. We discovered, and Paul is an accomplished attorney himself, defense and prosecutorial attorney. Paul is a consummate, very competent attorney." He says, quote, "We discovered some evidence that proves the government committed misconduct and used known perjured testimony." And then he asks, "Can you please have me contact a lawyer who is representing him?" And I try to reach her this morning. I left a message. I haven't gotten through to her yet. Mm-hmm. But whatever I can do with whatever this information is, whether it's writing about it, whether it's discussing it on air, I absolutely will use it to help Paul.
Well, I'm glad, because somebody has to. And, you know, it's not a surprise that the government would have engaged in misconduct, because I can tell you in the cases that I've served on, especially the Iron Triangle one, there was gross misconduct. There was evidence that was suppressed. There were witnesses that were coerced. There were witnesses that were sexually seduced. I mean, this stuff you would not believe unless you read a transcript and it was said under oath. But it's really all real and really all true. So unfortunately, it's just not, it may be a shock to some of your listeners, but it's not a shock to me at all that there would be prosecutorial misconduct.
Oh, it's not a shock to me at all either. I've written about so many cases, and I mean, literally, you go over the facts as we know them, and even some of it gets written up in dribs and drabs in major U.S. Newspapers, and mm-hmm. You discover that you're talking about people who literally never plotted anything, never
right.
did anything, never imagined committing a crime, and yet the facts are totally twisted, provocative. Informants paid off. Usually,
right.
I mean, the FBI and the Justice Department buy these people. Usually, it's somebody who committed some kind of an offense.
Exactly.
I mean, they could have committed murder. It doesn't matter what they did. But you grant them leniency
exactly.
in return for their being your guy going after an innocent person the government wants to commit. So they're
right.
lying for the government
right.
to get some leniency for themselves. And this happens repeatedly over and over. I mean, virtually one case after another. The
exactly.
same scheme is used. You use one of these people, you buy them off, and you pay them very, very well, many, many thousands of dollars and other benefits and so on, to railroad innocent people you want to put away. Most of the ones that I've dealt with have either been Muslims, the magic word, Muslim equals terrorist, quote-unquote, or environmental or animal rights activists. I have a new article that I did yesterday, Stepan, that I was planning to get out Saturday, but a couple of others preempted it, including one on Haiti, an update article that I put out today.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a woman by the name of Brianna Waters, an absolutely innocent woman who was bogusly charged on five counts. She was convicted back in 2008. I don't have the article in front of me. There were different dates depending on when the charges first arose and then her conviction. But her conviction was on two minor charges, exonerated on three major ones. Well, this didn't satisfy the Justice Department. So at the end of January, she was re-indicted on nine counts this time. I mean, they want to put this woman away, even though she's absolutely innocent. She did absolutely nothing. The case against her was totally fabricated, and these people are so vicious that they simply don't care how many lives they ruined in order to have so many more notches on their belt that they can chalk up as protecting the country from bad people. So it's either a Muslim terrorist or an environmental terrorist or an animal rights terrorist, and these people are activists for justice, and we call them terrorists.
Well, I agree with that. I would just add to your list, they also don't care if they have a highly decorated U.S. soldier.
Oh, yeah.
They just don't care, because what you're describing is standard procedure. It's perfectly legal. What they do is they offer immunity and a plea bargain to somebody that is going to testify against all the others, because they have no hard evidence. They have no physical evidence. I mean, the shocking thing in all these cases, every single one of them that I've defended, there's no bodies, there's no forensics, there's no reports that would ever firmly point the finger to the leader who gave the order and so forth. All you've got is the testimony of someone who is bought, but the way that they buy them is lower sentence and some benefits. And this is completely standard procedure, completely legal. And, I'm just wondering how the legal profession can go along with it. I mean, it's not called coercion, but it's clearly coercion.
Oh, it sure is, and the courts are so stacked with right-wing judges that they've basically been bought off. They get their appointments. They go along the judge at the district court level who tried Lynn Stewart, was angry at the Justice Department for going after her in the first place, and the Justice Department against her. She committed no crime. They contrived a crime. She defended an unpopular client, quote-unquote, a blind Muslim sheikh who worked for the CIA back, and the CIA got him a visa and brought him to this country, and then he outlived his usefulness, and they wrongfully blamed him for the 1993 attack on the World Trade Center that caused a lot of commotion, but certainly didn't do much more than that. And I wanted to put him away for life. He's a blind sheikh. But he was literally an asset of the CIA until they turned against him. And a former Attorney General of the United States, Ramsey Clark, asked Lynn to join his defense team representing this guy.
Right.
Because everybody under U.S. law deserves the right to be represented by competent counsel in court, even a guy who literally might have tried to blow up the World Trade Center. He still deserved his due process in court. And Lynn, as busy as she was, because Ramsey Clark asked, she took the case, and they went after Lynn for doing it. And not the Clinton administration, which is when she began, but the Bush administration. That there was the Clinton administration were far from saintly, but the Bush administration was absolutely corrupted and corroded with rogues, and they wanted to get Lynn, and they wanted to put her away for 30 years. But this judge in her case was so upset about the case being brought in the first place that he gave her 16 months. Which was a minor compared to what the Justice Department wanted.
Right.
But she appealed, and the appeals court, stacked with right-wing judges, came down with an angry verdict against her, demanding that the lower court rethink its sentence and come up with a different sentence. So the judge, after 16 months, gave her 10 years, and the reason is very simple. Because they're ambitious like everybody else. A district judge wants to be an appellate judge, and dare they dream that they could ever have a chance to be a Supreme Court judge. Well, you go against the system, and your career is over. So they go with the system, as bad and corrupt as it is.
That's right. And you have to also use common sense in who is being put away. You know, it's shocking that two of the people in Leavenworth, of the so-called Leavenworth 10, that's 10 soldiers who are supposedly war criminals, two of them have Purple Heart medals. I mean, I think that's the first time in history that I know of, and I've pored over the history of court-martials. You have these outstanding, literally, heroes. One of them, Michael Leahy, was a medic. He saved countless Iraqi and American lives. You know, it's just incredible. And then when you look at Paul Berggren, definitely a competent former prosecutor, competent defense attorney. I worked with him on some of these war crimes cases. He's a passionate defender of the rights under the Constitution of U.S. soldiers. You know, these are not guys that you would just look at and say, obviously a criminal. I mean, these are outstanding, you know, champions of the very liberties that the American Revolution achieved, you know, to tie back to our earlier conversation. So it's really very, very strange. But it just does not seem to be of much interest to the media or in general.
That's exactly right. The only reports that I read about Paul are the charges against him and maybe a trial date. When one
right.
comes up, trial dates can be very fluid. You can set a date and then change it. But Paul has been sitting under very harsh conditions in New York City jail. An honorable, innocent, decent guy, beaten up on so badly because he wanted the people really responsible for these gross criminal acts to be held accountable. That's his crime.
Right.
It really
is. Right.
It's a shocking indictment of our system.
Yeah, it is a fact that he openly wanted Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld to be put on the witness stand. I mean, he openly demanded it and, of course, was turned down, but he had every right to do so. He was going to make this link, which all the reports have already made, but make it at the time that it would have made a difference for soldiers' lives who were put away at Leavenworth. So that's one of the amazing things that he did compared to the other lawyers. At least he tried. He tried very hard. Of course, always turned down because that's never going to happen.
Oh, indeed not. And for the courage, for the chutzpah of wanting just to get these top people on the stand and question them.
Right.
And my understanding about Paul is that he was so competent, whether he was a prosecutor or a defense attorney, that nobody wanted to go up against him in court because your chances of prevailing were not too good. He would probably be clever enough to beat you, even a defense attorney, against a prosecutor with a rigged case. It might not be as rigged as they thought it was going up against Paul.
Right. I mean, people in the Abu Ghraib cases were getting sentences of 8 to 10 years. The case that I worked with him on, Javal Davis, the sentence was 6 months. He put up a really terrific fight.
Mm. You can see why they wanted to get rid of him. He was bucking the system that wanted everything their own way, and they wanted court-appointed attorneys. Defending
right.
the people that they wanted to put away. The kind of people who, what are they, earn $10 an hour? Well, a little bit more than that.
well, more than that, it's not just court-appointed in the military. So on top of that, they are subservient. They have to say, yes, sir.
Oh, just like these military commissions step in.
Exactly.
You know, you
so
get before a military judge.
Those guys are going to buck the system without
they're not
going to
buck the system at all.
Exactly.
Well, I read a quote, and I forget who it was from, but somebody involved at a high level with the military commissions saying one of the reasons for a military commission is when somebody goes before that court, they go there not to be exonerated. They go there to be convicted. It doesn't matter what they did or what they didn't do. The fact that they are sent before a military commission means that they are sent there to be convicted.
I can make that precise for you, Stephen. I looked at the data. It's a 94% conviction rate. If you are court-martialed, there's a 94% chance that you will be found guilty. Only 6% ever are found not guilty. That's how stacked the system is.
Talk about a corrupted system, and this is the best that the world has to offer. America, a beacon for other countries, democracy. Oh, my God Almighty, You dig down beneath the surface and you see the way this system runs, and we're only talking about the areas you and I are covering, Paul.
Right.
Stephen, but I mean you get onto the economic and finance side, and we already know the government, our government in Washington, mostly Obama before not George Bush, he began it, but mostly Obama. We know, and I suspect the numbers are greater. We know that our government gave $12.4 trillion, that's with a T like Tom, $12 trillion to gangster Wall Street bankers that engineered the economic crisis to crash the economy so they could buy assets on the cheap, so they could consolidate and be more powerful than ever,
give bonuses to their employees.
Oh well, business is better than ever.
Yes.
Because they also have license to rig the markets, to take them up when they want to have them go up, to take them down when they want them to go down, to rig the economic data to make it look better than it looks. We have a raging unemployment problem, and yet, my goodness, we changed the system we had 30 years ago. Under that system, before Ronald Reagan took over, we had a system the calculation used on unemployment then would have it at 22% today. Instead, we have the unemployment rate falling. The last two monthly reports, the unemployment rate has fallen, not because employment is going up, but because discouraged workers are dropping out of the workforce, and they don't get counted.
Right. Well,
if you've been looking for months and months and months and you can't find a job, and in the 30-day period you show up in the sample and you hadn't looked in that 30-day period, well, you don't exist anymore.
Right. Well, that's right. You can lie with numbers all you want, but the reality is coming through in the fact that the tax base is dropping precipitously. And so you've got cities and counties and districts that are firing firemen and policemen and teachers because there's not enough of a tax base to take care of basic needs at the local level. So that shows you right there, there's not enough income being generated. And this is a huge problem across the United States right now.
Especially in my own state of Illinois, which on a per capita basis, Stephen, has the worst problem in the country. I was shocked to find that out. I mean, literally, per capita, we're worse off in California. And it keeps getting worse every year. They're not making it any better. They keep laying off more people. They keep cutting more expenses. They keep going deeper in the hole. I'm just wondering how many years this is going to run before the entire state dissolves and there is no more state of Illinois.
Or California or Texas.
Oh, that's exactly right. And this year, going into this fiscal year, the combined stated deficit for all of the 50 states, I think it may be higher, but the stated number was $140 billion. Well, compare that to the $12.4 trillion we've given to Wall Street. So it's a minuscule percent of what we literally stole and gave away. And we could bail out the states and solve their problem, case closed, no more crisis.
Exactly.
It's not growing things. The fact that we're not doing this means we don't want to do it. We want to crash the economy. We want to put people in misery. Talk about a crime. Boy, is that ever a crime.
I agree.
Final comment. We're out of time.
Okay. Thanks for having me. It was a pleasure talking.
A final quick thought, Stephen. Anything you want to add quickly?
Yeah, I'm wondering how bad it's going to have to get before people in America take to the streets.
That's exactly what's on my mind. That is a great way to end the program. When will suffering Americans, millions and millions and millions of them, when are they going to say, we're not going to take it anymore, and we can be at least a little bit as courageous as the Egyptians? When are you going to do it? I sure hope it's going to happen. Stephen, this was a terrific hour. I look forward to doing it again with you.
I enjoyed it. Thank you, Stephen.
Thank you, Stephen. And join us every Thursday, 11 a.m. Eastern, weekends at 1 p.m. Oh, boy, this stuff is so important. You got to tune in and make it a regular habit.